And welcome back. Hour number two. We're going to do 2 hours coming your way next, and these are going to be just absolutely fascinating. So please sit back, watch your computer screen, click on the photos under Christopher Dunn in Guests, load that page up, because we are going to go on quite a walk. This is going to knock you over. Me, I can't wait. I always learn when Chris is on. Hello, my friend. Welcome back.
Hi, Jeff. Nice to be back. How
Indeed.
Are you?
I'm good. How has the response been to your first couple of visits?
Excellent. Very good. Very good responses. Everybody that heard the interviews thought that they were great, and they were kind of surprised at the information that I gathered and what was presented on the show, because this is the first time that it's actually been published over the radio or internet.
And, it truly was mind expanding, to put it mildly. When I look at that mega machine, that big wheel, that whatever it was, that idea fitting into that trench is genius to come up with that. It's almost like you're tuned into the collective universal timeless consciousness. I don't know. Maybe you pulled that out of reality from the distant past.
Well, actually, I did, because it's quite common in manufacturing plants and even other kind of large installations where you have a pit dug into the ground. Usually, if it's dug into the soil, it's lined with concrete, rebar, and what have you. Mm-hmm. And the lower parts of the machine are lowered into the pit. So it's not like they're I was totally unaware of that technique, our method, and pulled that out of the air from nowhere. It just seemed to make sense to me.
Well,
and I connected it with other stuff that I'd seen in my life.
Let me ask all of you who have the photos loaded up, and if you don't, please do. And I'd like you to scroll down where we're going to try and pick this up. You'll come to a picture. They're not numbered, but you'll see it. It's a long trench. You're looking straight down it. It's away from the camera. It seems to get a little wider in the middle. And then the next picture below that is a wide shot from up high of the area in question. And Chris has, with computers, drawn in what looks like a large bicycle wheel. All right? We'll just call it a wheel. It's a large wheel. Now, that large wheel, find those pictures, and that's what we're talking about here. That large wheel might have been one of several around that location. And what that wheel did, we could talk more about that. The next picture down, you have six on one page, lettered A through F. A, B, C, D, E, F. And I'd like to go back to those, Chris. If we can start there, maybe, and we can jump ahead. But this was so amazing. Looking at picture A, what I see in the bottom of that trench, now, how many different trenches do you think there are, or how many have you counted so far?
Well, we're looking at five separate trenches. I think C and D are photographs of the same trench, only from different directions.
Got it.
But A and B are separate trenches, E and F are separate.
Look at
the locations on the Giza Plateau.
Right. I'd like to draw everyone's attention to A. Now, in the bottom of A is another depression. It's elongated. If you were to imagine a big wheel turning, maybe it turned that little notch in the ground on its own. I mean, this is all so right. It's so correct. And looking at C and D, that is a remarkable construct.
Mm-hmm.
Has anyone gone into the bottom there and dug around to see if there's any particular kind of refuse in there? Not human trash, but
A study by a Russian research team called the ICIDA project.
Uh-huh.
And you can Google their name. They have a website that has an English translation pages.
But, how do we spell ICIDA?
ISIDA.
All right. Doesn't get any easier than that.
Yep. And they did some studies, and they climbed into one of the trenches, and there was an area of interest to their geologists and scientists that were on site.
Right.
And they took some samples back to Russia and had one of the labs analyze the material. It turns out that there was a high percentage of iron in the sample, but there were some other elements too that were of great interest, and one of them was ruthenium, which is an exotic metal.
Right.
And it's it generally used very sparingly, and is used in alloys, aerospace alloys, and things of that nature. So just the existence of those two materials, which when we think about what machines may have existed in ancient Egypt and the time frame to when they were actually used, whether you believe the conventional theory about the everything in, you know, starting around the first dynasty and the pyramids built in the fourth dynasty and so 4,500 years ago, or if you're more like me and you tend to look further in the past.
And me, I look at a period I call pre-ancient Egyptian history.
Yeah, I do too. I tend to favor the idea of a kind of a cyclical evolution where civilizations rise and fall, and on occasion there are dramatic changes and catastrophes, cataclysms that reset everything.
Right,
and
like Fukushima, for one, huh?
Well, even more drastic than that, you know, we're talking about extinction events.
That's right.
In history.
That's right.
Comet strikes and things
That's
of
right.
that nature.
By the way, which could happen any time, and I will bet you a dollar to a donut, more than that, that the government, such as it is, the controllers, they won't tell us. If they knew we were going to get hit, they're not going to tell us. Well, I mean, really, why, pragmatically speaking, I wouldn't blame them. But this could happen at any time, Chris. Well, a big asteroid could be on its way right now, 2 months out. 2 weeks out, which they, you know, they're always saying something just ran between the Earth and the Moon, and we didn't see it till it was already passed. Yeah, how many times have I heard that? Too many times.
Yeah, I don't know, but they probably did know about it. And,
oh, of course, but the stories are always designed to control the masses. All right, let's jump back to these pictures. I don't want to get too sidetracked here. Lots to talk about. A, B, C, D, E, and F. These are trenches. The typical ancient Egyptian folklore was that they were somehow used for boats.
Boat pits, yeah. but no, boats weren't found in these pits. There was a boat found in a rectangular pit near the on the south side of the Great Pyramid, and that's now housed in a building on the south side, a museum. The boat museum, but these pits did not have any remnants of boats in them.
No, not at all. All right, let's go ahead on, and we'll see another very interesting picture, especially the one of the pyramid at sunset or sunrise. Looks like sunset. It's off to the west, I believe, and the three wheels you can see there. Just to give you an idea of
that's just my impression of at the end of the day. As they're building the pyramids, you know, the wheels are still and everybody goes home and has a beer or something.
Isn't that funny? then we look at Dendera and...
could I...
please, go ahead.
You, but could we scroll up to some additional images I had Jeff upload to the site?
James, put them up there. Are they up high or are they down
James,
lower?
Yeah.
They should be down.
They are right below the table. Where it has the calculations to determine the diameter of the cutter.
Okay.
And it came to my attention that there was a misunderstanding of that calculation.
Is that with the picture of that has you in it, looking at the blade? How close to that are we?
Actually, I'm standing on top of the granite stone, and you can see the tripod legs. And there are some calculations on the
Okay, let me see. I'm going to count down. Hold on. One, two, three. Three, the third picture down, is that it? Before it shows you down on your knees.
That's like the eighth photograph down.
All right, let's go. One, two, three, four, five, six, seven, eight. Okay, we're looking down at the pyramid legs. I mean the tripod legs. Right.
Yeah, okay, below that there is a table.
Got it. All right.
And it shows that the cutter diameter is 37.5 for the blade. And because the radius is more than that, the radius is it's like a 23.684 feet. There was some confusion and a belief that 37.5 diameter was wrong. It should be 47.37 diameter, but the as I explained it on the radio show the week before last, last week, the when the blade is tipped, it forms an ellipse.
Interesting.
So
it's almost an oval shape
when you look down.
Got
and
it.
You actually can cut that 47.37 diameter with a 37.5.
It looks like an egg shape for those of you looking at it. It's an ellipse. Yeah, a very interesting idea. Now, when that would be spinning, that would be pretty wild, wouldn't it?
Yeah. Well, it's. I mean, it works if the blade is tipped or if the material is cut in on an angle. So.
Yeah. Very good.
All and right. There is a website that I put there that a person can read more about that technique.
And you'll see it. It says cutting large radius, and it's a link. You'll see it right under the picture. So, and then the next picture, you'll see Chris looking at a saw blade, and then you'll see the actual grooves or scoring. And look at the
the nature of that material.
Oh, it is
micarta. Yeah.
What an unusual formation. Oh.
Yeah.
Okay, very good. And then we can go back down, I guess. We can go next to the temple. And we didn't quite get to finish with the looking up from the ground toward the roof. I'd like to go over that again just briefly to give people an idea of what that roof in that temple is all about and the drawings in it and the simple fact that all the drawings in the roof of that temple and the material used to make that roof, stones, heavy blocks, were actually, what do we call them? Carved, chiseled, formed. They were impressed into that material before the material was raised up to the roof and lined up together and set in place. And those drawings fit perfectly together, even though they weren't done up there by men on scaffolds. All right? You got to understand, this was done on the ground. And they were hoisted
up. Yes, I mean,
the
general story that is told, and you can hear it if you're standing in the temple and Egyptologist tour guides bring groups through. They explain how the temple was built by building mud ramps, or earthen ramps, and they drag these stones into.
They're still doing that, huh?
Up the ramps and then pile them all up on top of each other until they get to the level of the roof. And then they start carving and work their way down, removing the ramp as they go.
So, well, mother is the necessity of invention, or is it, what is it? I forget, is it? Invention is the mother of necessity, or is it necessity is the invention of the mother? I never get that straight. Anyhow, all right, the point is...
I think that's too esoteric a question for me.
I think we'll leave that alone. Looking up from the bottom toward the top of the roof, you've got some really interesting pictures. We can spend a little time on those if you want. You got red lines and blue lines and enlargements and so forth. However you want to handle that.
As I explained last week, what I was trying to do was determine the alignment of certain features of the capitals, the Hathor capitals, with the sistrum friezes on top. And essentially there were several points that I had identified that... if they were in alignment, it would be quite telling regarding the precision, because essentially they were 2 points on a capital, one side of the capital, and those 2 points are on both sides at center, and I call them the AB intersection points, and these are identified in a line drawing above where I have my tripod set up with the lines, you know, for the
yeah. You can see it.
So anyway, those AB intersections are actually single points. They're not surfaces. And when you look at how the column was constructed and the potential for the accumulation of error as you stacked the blocks on top of each other, because each column was made up of separate pieces.
Mm-hmm.
And then you come to install the capitals, they would actually tell just how precisely they were positioned. And also just the fact that they are in such perfect alignment indicates that they had to have been manufactured outside the temple, and there's other evidence to prove that as we get further into this.
Mm-hmm.
But the AB intersection is where there is a three-dimensional contour, which is the headdress of Hathor, and you can see it better on the profile, where it's like a section of a torus or a donut, and then you have two flat surfaces coming in to meet that. That is the cornice that is above Hathor's headdress.
Mm-hmm.
So where those two surfaces meet, the curved surface is a single point in space. So you got two of those.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But you have other features of the capital too, which are interesting. But those 2 points I picked out because there was no ambiguity as far as whether they were picking up a part of a surface, or you know whether the alignment was actually related to something else in that area, because
right.
These are individual points that stick out.
Yeah, that, the
so
whole
when we
thing.
Go down to the first photograph, and we look at the alignment of the capitals, and you know, if you zoom in, and it may take a while for the eyes to adjust and actually pick up the points, but what I used blue lines and red lines to identify the AB intersection on the capitals.
Mm-hmm.
And on this one, we have 4 capitals, so it's the alignment between four corners of the capital and the AB intersection. And you can see where the blue lines cross and where the cornices meet at the intersection of those blue lines and the Hathor's headdress.
It's just amazing.
It's very clear. On the bottom left, it's very clear on that one.
Yeah.
And it's very clear on the bottom right, too, that you have that point clearly where the red and the blue lines meet is very accurate. And then, you go around and look at the other the magnified images of those the little circles. You can see where they meet.
Bunch of guys sitting around scratching on papyrus came up with this, right?
Right, and when you consider that the columns are like 60 feet up in the air, and then you can imagine that just any kind of movement, whether it's twisted slightly, or if the column is leaning a little bit, one column is leaning a little bit more than the other, either front and back or sideways. The fact that they all still in alignment after thousands of years is mind blowing.
It's got to be plumb. It's got to be square. It's got to be absolutely right angle perpendiculars. the geometry in here and the building of this is so far beyond, in my opinion, the ability of any ancient peoples that have been left to their own devices, that you got to start thinking of some kind of intelligence that was there's no question about it.
It's one thing, you know, it's just like all the other artifacts that we've discussed. It's one thing to talk about how these things were cut, but what kind of instruments and what kind of techniques were they using for alignment?
Right.
Because, you know, I mean, this is done with modern, this analysis
lasers.
Is done with modern technology,
yeah.
With digital cameras and CAD programs in a computer.
Yeah.
And so, you know, we have some fabulous tools for doing an analysis, and then to find this exists from prehistory.
And again, how tall is the ceiling? 60 feet, you said?
About 60 feet.
Wow. Wow.
Right.
Now look at the relief of the deer, just so you understand. Look at the placement of the blocks. Look at the creases, the lines where the blocks join.
Mm-hmm.
And look at the accuracy. Remember, this is all done on the ground, and then somehow these massive things were raised up and put into place, and look at the fit.
Mm-hmm.
Just
staggering. The listener would probably, you know, like to study those at leisure. We could move down to the next one, which involves six columns. And so you have the alignment of that AB intersection on six. Actually, 2, 4, 6, 8
uh-huh.
corners,
uh-huh.
and all of them similarly.
It's crazy.
Extremely
it's
accurate.
It's just alignment.
It's
absolutely stunning. Totally stunning. All right, we're going to take a little break. Come right back with Chris in just a couple minutes. You ready to move down to Luxor?
Well, there's a couple more images that.
All right,
I would
let's
like
do
to
that.
Discuss, but
and then we'll head on to Luxor. Yeah. We have much ahead for all of you, and for all of you, and that's most of you who will never see these in person. You're going to get a bird's eye view of some astounding work, as if what we've seen already isn't. Stay with us. Let's continue our interactive virtual tour of the monuments, some of them at Giza, with Chris Dunn. All right, Chris, go ahead. Let's look at. We're looking at more of these photos from the ground up at the temple.
Okay, we looked at the second image of the ceiling with the six columns. Now, if we go down to the image below that with the caption, photograph of four columns with construction lines and ellipses drawn on the bottom of Hathor's tresses. The key word here is ellipses that appear in, seem to appear in not just Egyptian architecture here at the Hathor Temple, but as we go through the Luxor Temple, we'll see that ellipses or ellipsoids appear there too.
Well, they look
the
just
first described by the Greeks.
For our listeners, the ellipse is a very interesting shape. It looks like an egg. All right, it's an oval, but it's
mm-hmm.
it's an ellipse. And I want you to pay close attention to this. We are let me count the pictures down. You've got the drawing with the camera pointing upward with the lines, four lines going left, four lines going right. And one, two, three photos below that. And you look at the egg-shaped ellipses that are at the bottom of the hair, is what the tresses of
yes.
Hathor. All right, go
yes.
ahead.
Right. And so just to actually find that feature, and begin to understand the geometric protocol that they were adhering to, brings it, you know, into a little sharper perspective. And also to understand that the ancient Egyptians were using ellipses in their art and architecture thousands of years before the Greeks described it. They described it, the ellipse, I think, in around 500 A.D. And Kepler was the first person, I think, in astronomy to actually describe the ellipse and use it in his work. But
Kepler, really, in space, yeah. Deep space. He was seeing ellipses in deep space. What, in galactic formations?
Right. So this is quite phenomenal when you consider it. But and so I just, you know, I think we've got the same situation with the AB intersections and the alignment of the columns and the same narrative that we talked about earlier. And listener can examine them at their leisure.
It's absolutely mind-boggling that a bunch of guys with mallets and little bronze chisels could do this. You got to think about this, folks. That's a standard wisdom when trying to explain away these magnificent relics from ancient pre-Egyptian history. That the Egyptians,
I think that, you know, for most of my readers and people who, you know, have been following my work, they are engineers and technical type people, and basically this is educational for them. With a practical knowledge of engineering, they don't even entertain the idea of considering copper chisels and primitive methods for creating.
It's something that's entirely not mentioned, not talked about in the common literature.
You can mention it, and you get a good laugh out of the crowd if you do.
Just one thing, Chris. I look up, and I see the ellipses in Hathor's tresses, her hair. I look at the other columns. They're all exact. I mean, if we tried to do this today, there'd be flaws. Your eye would pick up flaws. I'm convinced of it. There's no doubt. These things were absolutely template perfect.
Yes, and perfection is something I try to avoid. I mean, sometimes you get excited and say, look, that's bloody perfect. But perfection, there's always some error that exists somewhere.
Yeah, of course.
Just to the level of precision within a certain tolerance band, that is enough.
Staggering to me, just staggering.
That is enough to place these works into a totally different class. That speaks of a higher level of technology and intelligence.
Absolutely. And then you look at the artifacts of ancient hominids on the planet with their cone heads, let's call them, extended skulls, and you wonder, all right, you think,
all right,
this is called cranial capacity, not necessarily equating or equivalent to increased intelligence, but I wouldn't bet against it.
Well, right? I wouldn't dismiss anything completely out of hand. There's always more study and new information coming. And you never know where studies in one field are going to affect another one.
No. All right. Let's go on down and to our next major section, the magnificent temples at Luxor, the symmetry and the precision of the Ramses statues. And you better sit down for this one.
Yeah, go ahead, Chris. I'm excited to get on that, but there is one more image that I want to share with you that it kind of speaks volumes as to how the temple was built, and that is there's an image of the ceiling where there are two dogs, and you see
I thought they were deer. Now they are dogs. They look like Great Danes. I got it.
Yeah. So anyway, these were crafted, right, as we had discussed separately, and then put in position. But if you look at the joint on the dog on the left hand side, behind the neck and also the leg, there is an error, and it's not smooth, it's not joined, it's not complete like the dog in front. So there are two things that could happen for that condition to exist. I really don't think it was crafted that way originally. I think they probably had the shape crafted extremely well. I wouldn't say perfect, but enough so that you didn't see that
like
error.
The dog on the right. Okay.
Right. It'd be like the dog on the right. But if the block on the right was too long, or they had to shave something off, they may have cut that surface, thereby cutting away part of the features that would have made it match.
Got it. It's the very top of the leg that gets too thin. I see what you're saying.
Right. But it does actually prove that the carvings were made before the blocks were put in position.
And they were adjusted. Yeah.
Right.
Now,
right.
So I'm embarrassed. I did think those were stylized deer, I must admit. I thought I saw antlers up there, but that's just seeing things in clouds again. They're dogs, all right? They're great big dogs. I got it. I got it. But look at the tails on those damn dogs. Great Danes.
Yeah. Right.
All right.
So anyway, let's go down to the Temple of Luxor. And we have... outside the Luxor Temple, that is a magnificent temple. And there's an obelisk. You can see the obelisk. And then the seated statues, which are absolutely massive, as you can see.
Yeah.
You can see the people milling around at the bottom.
No, that is not a Cecil B. DeMille movie set either, although he did some pretty amazing things back in the day.
Yes, I've seen some of the Hollywood attempts to replicate.
This is the 1920s too.
They never quite get it right.
No, but got to give them an A for effort, babe. That's in the 20s and the 30s, way back when. But
they had
an idea. They had an idea.
No, but they've tried it in California, San Jose, the Rosicrucian Museum, the Egyptian Museum of and then there was the Luxor Temple, the Luxor Hotel in Las Vegas.
Right.
So anyway, yeah, you do have models that have been made.
But look at this thing is, again, it boggles the mind to think about this. Who were these people? What were they all about? What was their knowledge source? Where did they come from? Where did they go? Amazing.
Exactly, and all those questions go through your mind. It's quite humbling, especially for an engineer to be faced with this kind of work.
All right.
And if you go down to the second photograph, that image there is a profile view of one of the seated Ramses that you see in the first photograph. Except that's at night, where they're lit up, and the photograph was taken with a telephoto lens from the Nile, or the road that runs by the Nile, which is called the Corniche. And there is some interesting features of the crowns. You see that they have a crown sitting on the head. Those are separate pieces.
Mm.
And we're going to examine a couple of those as we... scroll further down. And the next
I assume that's a beard. I can't see from this angle. Is that the beard coming off the chin?
That's the beard of Ramses.
Right.
Essentially, it's very interesting. The beard is a symbol of authority. And even, I think it was Hatshepsut wore a beard because she was a pharaoh. Mm-hmm. And so, but she wore a false beard.
One would hope.
Her authority.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
The going down, we are looking into the Ramses Hall, and you have several statues, very large statues in the Ramses Hall. And these are in various states of destruction. None of them have the white crown on them, but you do see the crowns seated in front of them, and they're positioned at the base.
What is it, Chris? The crowns?
Yes, the crowns.
Okay.
These are the white crowns of Upper Egypt, and they were a status symbol. But there was something very incredible about it that caught my attention. I first visited the Luxor Temple in 2004 with a tour group, and everybody was, you know, interested in what was kind of crafted in the walls, the reliefs and hieroglyphs and what have you. And my attention was drawn to these granite objects that intrigued me. And I went over to examine them, and I just ran my hand over the surface of the crowns, and it's like it felt to my hands like it just come out of a machine because it was, you know, just beautiful, perfectly crafted, with no bumps, no ripples, no dips or anything like that, and extremely smooth and seemingly very accurate. And, you know, that intrigued me, but I left it at that, and I didn't go back there until 2006.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, walking around the Ramses Hall, and you just get into the nooks and crannies, if you go down to the next photograph, you see the backside of the statues received very high detailed attention. And the pleats on the pharaoh's skirt are actually half rounds. They're circular bottoms, but the cusp where two pleats meet,
mm-hmm.
the cusps are very sharp. There's no damage to the cusp.
Now we're looking at the picture. It's below the last of the two lighted pictures. There's no lights visible in it. It's the backside,
right.
The left arm, the backside of one of the
right.
sculptures. And look
right.
at those lines on the pleats. Yeah. Would that have been the lower body garment?
Yes. Yeah. Uh-huh. It's like a skirt that the pharaohs wore.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, that to look at that, and then when you see how it was cut, and the material that was left, like between the arm and the body, and how flat and square and how small a radius there is in the corners, that's quite interesting.
Fascinating.
But
is the arm itself polished? Granite, is that it? Is that what we're seeing?
Yes, the arm itself and the whole torso
mm-hmm.
is highly finished granite. And they're beautifully crafted statues. If you go down to the one below that shot of his backside, you
mm-hmm.
can
mm-hmm.
You can see that this is a small section of another statue. And there is a in relievo carving of Nefertari, and she's got a hand on the back of the pharaoh's calf. And essentially, these are walking statues, so they signify movement.
She's not very tall, if that's the back of his calf.
That's the back of his calf.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
Well, he's tall. No, I mean, she is super small.
Yeah,
she's about life size
uh-huh.
when you're there, and he's quite thereabouts. I would say about 15 feet tall.
Why is she nudging him to keep moving? What's the thought about that? Is
well,
there any?
She's a woman, right?
Oh, sorry. Stepped in that one, didn't I?
That signifies that men, if women weren't pushing them and moving them, they wouldn't get that much done, right?
That's funny. And those symbols mean nag in Egyptian,
so
right?
They're the motivation. That's what keeps us moving, right?
That's funny. Very good.
Anyway, so that was an interesting diversion, I know.
Yeah.
Going down to the photograph below that, this is a photograph of a crown. I took a photograph in 2006 of that, and I had a handheld camera. And when I got back to my room, I was thinking that it seemed to be quite uniform and symmetrical from one uh-huh. side to the other. So
right.
I had the equipment that I could examine it. I made a copy of the photograph, and I flipped it horizontally and made a transparency of it to compare one side to the other. And so if you go to the photograph below that, you see a copied reverse transparency comparing one side.
Oh, my. Look at that. See, I'm going along. I'm not looking ahead. A copied reverse transparency to compare one side of the crown with the other. Look at that. It is
right.
A mirror perfect. Absolute.
But I left a shadow there intentionally. So
yeah.
You would know that this is two images coming together.
Just
so
extraordinary.
Going down to the one below that.
Uh-huh.
That is where there is a complete overlay, and that shows the consistency from one side of the crown to the other.
How did they do it?
Very interesting. And it's going to get more interesting, Jeff. Let's go to the next one. This is a different one. Originally, the crown would have been attached to the head, because you can actually see the remnants of the eyes in the at the bottom there. But I was trying to determine what the geometry of the crowns was, and I used two radii, the same radius, and
uh-huh.
And copied it and actually lined one up on one side in the same radius. Lines up with the one with the other side. So I was trying to determine the geometry and whether they were actually perfect circles. But finally, after examining the whole thing, and I describe the process in my book, Lost Technologies of Ancient Egypt, of trying to come to terms with these pieces. But we can see in the following photograph, which is a black and white image, that an ellipse actually fits the geometry of these crowns better if you take into consideration not just the sides that we're looking at now,
mm-hmm.
but looking at it from the front, but also looking at it from a profile view and determining what the shape is from the front. And essentially what we have is a modified ellipsoid, and basically when you look in my book, I have photographs looking down, and they are circular when you look down on them.
Mm-hmm.
And so essentially what you've got are ellipsoids, which is it's one thing to craft an ellipse and draw it on paper. It's quite another thing to manufacture an ellipsoid.
In three-dimensional reality, I don't even have a clue. I couldn't guess. And you're a professional. What is the notch in the crown that we see in the bottom of it?
The notch in the crown, which one?
The one with the ellipsoid drawn over it. There's a notch in the bottom.
That probably contained the cobra. I would
mm-hmm.
I would guess
mm-hmm.
that it had, you know, it
You
know,
mentioned you mentioned
the
that one
generally
the,
is seen with a cobra. You
yes.
can see it, in, right?
Yes, yes. You mentioned
right.
there were remnants of an eye or eyes on one of them. In other words, was that one knocked off the top of the statue at some point?
All of these were originally installed on top of the statues.
And they were knocked down and somebody
and
propped
the heads,
them back up.
The heads rolled and statues rolled too. Something happened very drastically that caused a lot of destruction. And you can see that some of the statues were separated actually at the shoulders and others were separated.
Are you talking about an earthquake here?
Yeah, I think we're talking about a massive earthquake changes.
All right.
That cause a massive destruction throughout the country.
All right, hold on a minute.
World.
Yeah, on the world. Yeah, this could have been an impact earthquake. It could have been a geological event. Could have been anything.
Right, exactly.
Hold on, and we'll be back more to see with Christopher Dunn after the top of the hour break.